and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington, and here are some of the top stories making news across South Sudan, Sudan, and the rest of the region this Monday, October 14th, 2024. Some Juba fuel stations forced to shut down defy orders and are up and running again.
We reiterate to the government that a petrol station in the residential area like this one is not good.
And some Juba residents facing challenges persevere.
In any culture or any country, culture can be defined through food. So when you are like a country, always you are obsessed to eat your own local food. I know there are many local food in the country, but this place is a bit different.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Some fuel stations located in residential areas whose operating licenses were revoked and banned from operating in South Sudan's capital, Juba, have resumed supplying fuel to motorists in parts of Juba town amid complaints from residents about the dangers of operating such a station in residential areas. Manyang David Mayar reports for VOA from Juba.
In March this year, the former governor of Central Equatoria State, Emmanuel Adil Anthony, shut down over 15 fuel stations situated in residential areas of Juba because the stations were considered dangerous to nearby residents. 6 months later, all the fuel stations that were closed are back up and running, sparking complaints from some residents of Juba town. One such resident, Sunia Knight, says her family lives in constant fear of a fire outbreak because she lives close to a gas station.
From the very beginning, we have been rejecting this petrol station. It was closed, but now you can see it operating. We reiterate to the government that a petrol station in the residential area like this one is not good. They should take it far from us because this may bring fire.
Knight says she fears leaving her kids at home whenever she goes to the market for fear of a fire outbreak at the station. Ernesto Rafael, another Juba resident, says he has repeatedly complained and called for the removal of a fuel station next to his house, but authorities are doing very little to intervene.
I cried out every day that we don't need fuel station here, but nothing was done. We don't need this fuel station. It should be taken far away because in case of any fire, it can bring destruction to this area. You can see my fence here is made of reed. Any small fire, it can quickly spread to the whole area.
Lona Alfred, another Juba resident, says fuel stations located in residential areas poses risks to residents.
Our rights are being violated with the establishment of this fuel station. Any small mistake can cause fire from here. One day, there was a fighting here and a bullet almost hit this fuel station. It would have caused a big fire.
Angelo Dyer, the Central Equatoria State Security Advisor and the head of the committee tasked with closing fuel stations in Juba residential areas, says Agostino Jadalawani, governor of Central Equatoria State, is expected to ban petrol stations in residential areas.
His Excellency is going to reactivate the order. And then the one who opened without the order that was given by the former administration, they are going to be closed and punished.
The administration of some fuel stations that were closed declined to comment when contacted by VOA. Some owners of the petrol station say that they have been permitted to reopen and say they operate under the authority of some unnamed government institutions. The Juba City Council said earlier this year that petroleum companies operating in the city are guided by some safety requirements. In 2026, at least 6 people were killed and 9 others wounded after a fuel tanker veered off the road and exploded in the Gumba residential area. In 2015, over 200 people were killed following a fuel tank explosion in Maridi County of Western Equatoria State. For VOA News, I'm Anyang David Mayer in Juba.
Some women with restaurants in Juba say offering local dishes has boosted their profits. The manager of the Mango Camp restaurant, which specializes in local South Sudanese cuisine, says her clientele has increased thanks to people like Ethiopians and other foreigners who love South Sudanese food. Dennis Lagonye has more for VOA from Juba.
The famous Mango Camp is located at the bank of the River Nile, sandwiched between two giant hotels. During lunchtime, commuters on foot and by car race here to get a taste of the local delicacies sold in the restaurant. Mango Camp manager Aluel Majer says her customer care skills, resilience and hope for development gives her the conviction to beat her competitors in Juba.
The main dishes that we do are fish, which is tilapia, bamia, kudra combo, shorba, jidad. The main reason I bring customers here is what we cook. If you come to South Sudan, you're welcome to Mango Camp, where we do local dishes. We do it as like you're doing it in your own house.
Lucador Ayen is a regular client of Mango Camp. He says the food and the river view keep him coming back to Mango Camp.
This is a local restaurant, and in any culture or any country, culture can be defined through food. So when you are like a country, always you are obsessed to eat your own local food. I know there are many local food in the country, but this place is a bit different from others, because the way local food are cooked in this place, food that are cooked in a way that it will be good in the stomach. Second to that, South Sudanese, we want to be next to the river.
Majer says South Sudan's economic crisis has affected many Juba businesses, so it's harder to stay in business.
We're having challenges in the market. Buying things from the market, it's not that easy, because like today you find prices are different, tomorrow's different thing. Prices are always not stable. We buy things at different prices daily, and buying things at different prices daily, it's a big challenge in order to maintain on how to sell whatever you have cooked in the kitchen. It's not easy.
Majer says she has learned to turn challenges into business opportunities.
I've had experience and I'm able to manage people, I'm able to manage a business and know how to manage my money and how to run the whole place. Yeah, you know, managing people and running a restaurant is not easy. You have to be there and see how things are done. Customer service is also important. How you interact with the customers is also important. Like, if you interact with them in a nice way, they keep on coming back. If your workers are happy, they are able to do your work according to your expectation.
Small-scale businesses in South Sudan depend solely on the capital they earn from sales. Vendors across Juba struggle to survive, to stay afloat in a hostile environment that offers no government-sponsored loans for expanding businesses. For VOA News, I'm Dennis Logonyi reporting from Juba.
Following the 7th Africa-China Summit in Beijing recently, questions are being asked about whether African nations have the agency to shape the China-Africa relationship moving forward. In his new report, Reimagining African Agency in Africa-China Relations, Paul Nantulia, senior researcher at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, tells me in the second and final part of our conversation that many African leaders are willing to follow China's military and strategic initiative in order to get what they want.
It's not altruistic. It is strategic in the sense that it allows China to position itself as a preferred partner.
Could China's initiative be viewed as good for developing countries in Africa?
Well, that question depends on African countries themselves. There are many examples of African countries that have managed their relations with China quite strategically in ways where they are able to get beneficial outcomes while mitigating the risks. Right. So there are countries like Liberia, for instance, countries like Senegal, countries like Ghana that have been able to manage, countries like Ivory Coast and quite a few others that have been able to manage their relations with China in ways that do not incur debt burdens, in ways that ensure that livelihoods are protected, that local industries are protected and that sort of thing. The problem is that those positive examples are not even. It's not even across the African continent. That is where the problem is. But really, the ball is going to be on the African side, right, in terms of the level of agency that they'll be able to exert in managing and balancing their relationships. There are quite a number of things that African countries can do to leverage their relationship, to put their relationship on a more equal footing. And these are issues that are not new. These are issues that have been raised by African observers, African experts on China-Africa relations, on think tanks, independent African scholars. You know, there's a groundswell of opinion on the African continent that are putting concrete proposals on the table on how African countries can actually manage their relationship in a more strategic way.
Do African leaders seem willing to go along with China's plans in order to get what they want?
Yes, for the most part, it's a quid pro quo relationship, right? I do for you and you do for me, right? In Chinese, this is known as guangqi, right? These are relationships, right, that are built on granting concessions to the other party in order to gain from the other party, right? So they're exchanges, right? So when you look at the positions that African countries take diplomatically, right, when you look at, for instance, discussions on things like Xinjiang, discussions on the Hong Kong security law, and other issues like Taiwan, issues around Tibet, whenever those issues come up in the UN Human Rights Council and in other multilateral organizations, African countries have a tradition of voting alongside China and defending China and defending Chinese interest. I think it's important to remember that, to recall, when the former Speaker of the House, when Nancy Pelosi visited Taiwan, the criticism that came from outside of mainland China, the vast majority of criticism came from African governments. African governments were very quick to condemn Nancy Pelosi, right? But African countries are not doing that just because, you know, Taiwan is far away. It doesn't really affect African countries directly. But there are things that African countries are looking for in return, right? Loan finance, infrastructure finance, you know, energy and things like that. So it is an exchange. And a lot of the time, China is described, China-Africa relations are described as very transactional. African countries are also very transactional in the ways that they engage the People's Republic of China.
You noted that, speaking of the UN, you noted that China didn't even mention the push by several African leaders to get two permanent seats on the UN Security Council. Is that significant?
Well, I mean, it's significant in the sense that the Chinese position is not clear. So China rhetorically has a foreign policy stance of supporting, amplifying and strengthening African interests in multilateral affairs and in championing the reform of the multilateral system in ways that promote African interest. But when it comes to African representation on the Security Council, the Chinese side has been ambiguous. In terms of, does China support African permanent representation on the council? One. Two, does China support a veto for African countries? The Chinese position is very ambiguous.
That was Paul Nantulia, senior researcher at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies. He was speaking with me earlier in Washington. You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up on South Sudan in Focus, the World Health Organization says the health sector should be high priority for all governments. More on that when we come back. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. A regional partnership for Nile River Basin country says an agreement on the equitable use of water resources has come into force, despite the notable opposition of Egypt. The Nile Basin Initiative Group said in a statement Sunday that the legal status of the cooperative framework among 10 states was formally confirmed by the African Union after South Sudan became the sixth country to ratify the accord. The Associated Press reports that Ethiopia, Uganda, Rwanda, Burundi, and Tanzania have also ratified the agreement. Egypt, Sudan, Congo, and Kenya are yet to ratify it. The accord takes force amid tensions in the region that stem in part from Ethiopia's construction of a huge dam on the Nile that Egypt fears will have a devastating impact on water and irrigation supplies downstream. The Associated Press says the lack of ratification by Egypt and Sudan have raised concern over any attempts to diminish their shares of Nile water, and that means the accord will prove controversial. The World Health Organization is calling on governments and stakeholders to invest in the health sector. Speaking during the opening ceremony of the World Health Summit 2024 in Berlin, WHO Director General Tedros Ghebreyesus said investment is a critical step in strengthening the ability of health systems. Maureen Ogiambo reports.
The World Health Summit is a leading global health conference and network that brings together stakeholders from the political class, science, the private sector, and the civil society from around the world. WHO Director General Tedros Ghebreyesus says more investment leads to healthier population and more equitable, stable, and secure societies and economies.
And this year's World Health Assembly, member states adopted a new and ambitious strategy to save 40 million lives over the next 4 years. Delivering that strategy requires a strong and sustainably financed WHO, which is why we have launched the first WHO investment round to mobilize upfront the predictable funding we need to do our work over the next 4 years.
The three-day event is being held in Berlin, Germany, virtually under the theme Building Trust for a Healthier World. Tedros says when people lose trust in healthcare, the consequences become deadly.
Everything we do depends on the trust of the communities we serve. Strong partnerships are built on trust. Trust has always been the foundation of medicine and public health. People won't use a medicine they don't trust, or see a health worker they don't trust, or follow advice they don't trust.
Among the subjects of discussion during the summit are financing global health solutions, creating a roadmap to future resilience, strategies for women's and children's health, pathways to action for equity, strengthening voices for impact, and artificial intelligence in health. African Centers for Disease Control Deputy Director General Tajuddin Mohamed Raj says Africa is far from achieving an adequate healthcare workforce due to lack of support.
For instance, if you look at the field epidemiology training program at the advanced level, we talk of ratio 1 to 200,000. Today in Africa, we are far from that because for a population of 1.4 billion people, you are talking of roughly 7,000, epidemiologists. So to really address some of the recurrent outbreaks on the continent, we need to support workforce.
A research fellow at the University of Cape Town, Bessie Malila, says in South Africa and other African countries, technology and computers are used to analyze and create clinical documentation.
For TB, there is opportunities for computer-aided detection. We're looking at cough detection using AI technologies, latent TB detection. We're looking at radiomic technologies, also looking at AI-driven image analysis and transfer learning. Opportunities for patient tracking, self-counseling, risk determination, rapid testing, and linkage to care. Opportunities in applying AI in linkage to HIV care.
The World Health Summit leaders say trust between different levels of governance is essential for better decision-making in public health emergencies. For VOA Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in San Francisco.
Studies from the American Psychiatric Association show that as the elections approach, stress levels go up, regardless of political affiliation. The constant stream of news, stressful arguments, and concerns about the country's future all put pressure on mental well-being. Psychologists call it election stress disorder. Maxim Adams has the story.
The November 5th presidential election causing anxiety for nearly three-quarters of those surveyed in an American Psychiatric Association poll. Some psychologists are branding this phenomenon election stress disorder. Lynn Bufka with the American Psychological Association.
The political climate and discussions about the election had become a lot more heated and a lot more divisive, and we wondered if that was having an impact on individuals. And certainly their self-reported experience of it was that indeed that has been a significant source of stress for many individuals. And other research has also found similar kinds of results.
Political stress affects many aspects of life, says University of Nebraska-Lincoln political science professor Kevin Smith.
A fifth to a quarter of Americans reports ruptured social relationships. Maybe even problems at work because of politics.
Smith's research shows that young people, as well as those with left-leaning views and those more involved in politics, are more prone to election stress.
We know how to mitigate the health effects. It's just stop paying attention to politics, just tune out. The problem with that is that might be good for individual health, but it's not particularly good for civic health.
Stress management specialist Dr. Kiran Dintiala, known as Dr. Kam, recently published a book called The Mantra of Peaceful Politics, where he shares his advice of how to avoid excessive stress during the pre-election period.
Elections come and go. Politicians come and go. It might change their future, maybe 10%, 20%, maybe 30%, but for most part, their future, their happiness depends on what they do every single day in their life, their behaviors, their emotions.
But Bufka says there is a way out of the psychological malaise. She says it is all about exerting control over where you get your information and also about doing something, anything, instead of doom-scrolling political stories.
Constantly exposing ourselves to negative information, negative images, negative rhetoric is going to elevate our overall sense of negativity and stress. So we have some control there. Another thing that we encourage people to think about is engaging in meaningful activities, whether it's related to the election or to current societal issues or problems that are important to you.
APA stresses that it is important to remain calm and maintain social relationships, as spending time with loved ones. An active lifestyle and healthy eating and sleeping can all help reduce anxiety in the days before the election. Maxim Adams, VOA News, Washington.
On Sunday, U.S. President Joe Biden visited areas affected by Hurricane Milton in Florida and announced $500 million in new funding to improve electric grid resilience. Even as relief and recovery efforts continue, officials warn that misinformation is spreading rapidly as Election Day draws near. VOA's Veronica Balderas Iglesias has the details with reporting from Patrick Bresnan in North Carolina.
U.S. President Joe Biden surveyed Sunday the areas devastated by Hurricane Milton in Florida. He also announced $612 million in funding to support the communities affected by both Milton and the hurricane that preceded it, Helene.
This funding will not only restore power, but will make the region's power system stronger and more capable and reduce the frequency and duration of power outages while extreme weather events become more frequent.
This information surrounding the federal government's response, however, has spread rapidly. Secretary of Homeland Security Alejandro Mayorkas told CBS's Face the Nation he is incredibly concerned.
It is extremely pernicious. We have individuals in need of assistance who are entitled to assistance who aren't seeking it because of the false information. We need individuals, elected officials, people who have the platform to really debunk this false information, and we're not seeing enough of that.
Democratic presidential nominee and Vice President Kamala Harris spent the weekend in North Carolina. On Saturday, she joined relief efforts as the western part of the state grapples with the aftermath of Hurricane Helene. Harris's political rival, former President Donald Trump, has criticized the Biden administration for what he considers a poor hurricane response. Trump's vice presidential pick, J.D. Vance, was asked Sunday about falsehoods promoted by the former president, including that aid to Republican disaster victims is intentionally being withheld by federal government agencies or given to undocumented migrants.
We've got Republican congressmen who are on the ground who represent that area saying that they have to call the White House to get food and water to FEMA. I don't frankly think there's anything malicious going on here, Martha, but I do think that we've had an incompetent response to this particular crisis.
VOA toured hurricane-stricken areas in the city of Asheville, North Carolina, and spoke with some of the affected about the government's response. Elliot is one of the affected residents.
From what I've seen, just in the air, helicopters, all that kind of stuff, we've seen National Guard driving around. I mean, I think there is a decent response.
Business owner Dan Junkie.
We haven't had any support from our government or FEMA or the city government yet, but it may be coming still.
As resources are running out, Congress is being urged by the Biden administration to approve additional emergency disaster funding before the presidential election on November 5th. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News, Washington.
And that wraps it up for us this Monday. We invite you to check out voaafrica.com for all your favorite programs and news updates. If you somehow miss the beginning of this broadcast, just head on over to www.voaafrica.com/South Sudan. We now leave you with the song Dismajos by Shen Shen. We've been listening to the song Shen Shen by the group Dismajos. I am your host, Carol Van Dam in Washington. On behalf of our engineer, Helen Corden, and producer, Kwame Afori, thanks for tuning in. We'll see you back here tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States has sanctioned a senior leader of the Rapid Support Forces, Algoni Hamdan Daglo Musa, for his involvement in efforts to procure weapons and other military materiel that have enabled the Rapid Support Forces' ongoing operations in Sudan. This includes the assault on Al-Fashir, the capital of North Darfur. Algoni's actions have fueled the war and brutal Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, atrocities against civilians, which have included war crimes, crimes against humanity, and ethnic cleansing. Rather than heed warnings from the United States and other partners, the RSF and its allied militia have continued to commit atrocities, including those involving sexual violence and ethnically targeted attacks on non-Arab groups. Algoni is the RSF's procurement director and one of the younger brothers of Mohammed Hamdan Daglo, or Hemeti, the head of RSF. He is close to Hemeti, having also previously worked as his personal secretary. Algoni has controlled RSF front companies, including the Office of Foreign Assets Control sanctioned Tradive General Trading, which imported vehicles to Sudan on behalf of the RSF. The war between the Sudanese armed forces and the RSF has caused immense devastation, with tens of thousands of dead and more than 11 million displaced, both internally and externally. The Sudanese people demand and deserve peace and justice and a return to civilian government, said State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller in a statement. At a time when the United States, the United Nations, the African Union, and others are advocating for peace, key individuals on both sides, including Algoni Hamdan Daglo Musa, continue to procure weapons to facilitate attacks and other atrocities against their own citizens, said Acting Undersecretary of the Treasury for Terrorism and Financial Intelligence Bradley Smith. The United States will continue to hold accountable those who seek to prolong this conflict and restrict access to vital humanitarian assistance at a time of famine and fragility. The United States will continue to use the tools at its disposal to support a peace process and impose cost on those perpetuating the conflict.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.